The secret of life is eat as much peanut butter as you can, protect your big brother from no good women, and listen to In the Corner back by the woodpile every day.
I'm Spun Counter Guy, thanks for coming by. Because of cultural or historical low information, we can sometimes make incorrect assumptions about whole societies and time periods, even our own. One might mistakenly think that giant moths and turtles battling in the skies while twin girls speak in unison on behalf of the moth is something commonly seen in Japan. Or one might also incorrectly assume that America invented slavery, racism, guns, cancer, and overeating until we have to shop at a store called Dress Barn. If we don't know any better, how would we know any better? Well, my guest back by the woodpile today is Sanchiro Hanafusa, a man with feet on two sides of the Pacific, and who will try to help us know a little more any better.
Okay, so what's your background?
Father's side's from Japan, the Okinawan Islands. Part of that goes back to mainland China, about 10 generations prior to that.
Really?
Yeah.
How did they find that out?
Japan keeps a very close record of that. They don't have, like, always just, like, birth certificates. We have a... It's something that goes on your wall. It actually just writes down name to family connections. So my father and my grandfather kept really good track of all that. And so they know about 10 generations ago our family was married into some people from mainland China. Now my other half side comes from the U.S. Uh-huh. From Tennessee, which is mostly, like, you know, French American. And then about another half of my mother's side is Cherokee.
So, growing up with this mixed-race heritage, as a child, are you aware of that?
Oh, you're definitely aware of it. There's no way around it, because especially when you go to school, you know, you have a foreign name, you just look a little different, so even kids notice that. Mm-hmm. And my mom knew that, so they told me stories about all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it plays into everything that, you know, we did. My mom knew some Cherokee stuff, mm-hmm. and my dad taught us some Japanese. And he, you know, they'd make us Japanese, like, lunches to take to school. So, you know, I had all this, like, you know, other kids were eating, like, pizza and macaroni. And I had a lunchbox with, like, curry rice and, like, sushi rolls and stuff in it. And they're like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know? For some reason, now it's really in. But back in the late 80s or 90s, it was something that there was a joke about. I'm not as cool for kids back then, so.
Modern times, obviously, America's so, I think, overtly race conscious, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and even, like the progressives are so intent about labeling people. Like,
yeah, I know.
And how do you feel about that? Because, I mean, obviously, it'd be a pretty big label to put on you. I mean,
just recently, like, you know, redoing my recertification where I lived, the thing is, you know, check off your ethnicity. And I'm like, okay, Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, you know, Caucasian, well, all three.
Yeah.
You know.
You just check them all the boxes. Huh?
Yeah, but some places you have to check one. I'm like, which one applies to you the most, you'll say. I'm like, how can you describe which one applies to you the most? If you're a person who actually has tracked your family genealogy, you know what they are. Most, you know, I like to look at a little bit of all of them.
Mm-hmm. Even most, you know, Caucasians in America are mixed of something. I mean, whether it be all the different European countries.
It's French, Irish, you know, that.
Native America, I mean.
And you know, Chinese immigration camps. Yes, you might be 1/16 Chinese. You might have all these little blends. You've got, and most of the Western, you know, British settlers did interbreed with some natives over time, so you probably have some native something in you of all mixes. Mm-hmm. There's not really any pure bred, really, in the US on that. Okinawa was originally not part of Japan. It's part of the Ryukyu Island chain, and it was actually its own kingdom, like Hawaii. It had a king, a queen, had its own written language, and its own spoken language as well. Different from mainland Japan. Mm-hmm. And mainland Japan, up until a certain time, respected that boundary between the two. Mm-hmm. So they have different customs, even different Shinto gods and religions. It's completely different down there.
Mm-hmm. So technically, they're not Japanese.
Technically, not. It's kind of like the I've been confused by the pronunciation, the Ainu, whatever.
Ainu, uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like that.
For my generation of comic book fans, it was made famous by David Max Kabuki, if you ever...
Yes, Kabuki, yeah. So it's the same as that. They were their own entire culture, mm-hmm. and ethnically a little bit variant, mm-hmm. originally. But mm-hmm. the main thing with them was they were autonomous on their own until, I think it was 1600s or so. It was a certain time in feudal era Japan, or late, just after that, where Japan wanted, kind of like China, they wanted a unified feel. Mm-hmm. And so that's when they went after Okinawa, finally, to be part of the Japanese main country. And it wasn't quite as peaceful a thing as you would think. In fact, it actually harkens a little bit to the era of the Nazi methodology. Hitler made people wear those Jewish stars, mm-hmm. if you were Jewish. Well, same thing happened there. Mainland Japan went down into Okinawa, and they basically removed the king and queen. And then they basically said, if you speak Okinawan, you got to wear something on yourself. They're trying to make people feel like you were different. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to wipe out the Okinawan language, Okinawan culture, make people all just Honshu Japanese.
Mm-hmm. How successful were they?
Very successful. There was some resistance, but it worked overall. To the point now, little remains of it. Only mostly people in their 70s and 90s speak the Okinawan language. Some of the Okinawan culture, like, very unknown to most of the world now. Most of Japan doesn't even know it. And in fact, there are even certain... those stamps you'll see on packages you buy from Japan, mm-hmm. some of those are Okinawan in origin, and now modern people, some of them don't know what they mean anymore. Mm-hmm. They were actually part of Japanese Okinawan kanji, mm-hmm. and no one knows what they are anymore. Eventually, they realized an entire language culture was being forgotten. Then they had a change of heart, and they said, whoa, wait a minute, and they started trying to find it and preserve it, mm-hmm. after they tried to get rid of it.
Right.
So my grandmother still speaks Okinawan, mm. or actually, specifically, each island in it had its own little dialect, too. She speaks Arabu. So they don't say Neko for cat. They say Miao. M-E-A, Miao.
Yeah, we talked about this because the Chinese, the Mandarin is Mao.
Yeah. Traditional Japan does cremation, and then they put them in a pot. Or and it goes in front of a stone that has your name on it. And different families can be added to it, and the pots are lined up behind it. Well, apparently in Okinawan burial, they believed it was kind of like you return to the womb again. So they actually shaped their tombs as opposed to being just that traditional stone that we're used to seeing in Japanese burial. They actually have it shaped like a concrete womb. It's a dome.
Really?
And your urn goes inside of this, and all your family members go in that, but it's shaped, and the inside is actually shaped anatomically to a woman's womb.
Wow.
And so you're supposed, it's like when you die, you return to it. I was always fascinated with the mythology around the Makuro Kurosuke, or dust bunnies, as they're jokingly known. You'll see them in things like Totoro. Uh-huh. You'll see them in there. Those little black soot things.
Yeah.
They go poof. There's a whole story behind those.
Spirited Away, right?
They may appear in multiple things.
Okay, sure.
Miyazaki uses them a lot, but they're a big part of Japanese mythology and folklore. Supposedly they live in old, you know, abandoned things. They're like spirits of nature, and they inhabit things that are no longer used. Mm-hmm. But when people go back into them again, and there's laughter and enjoyment and like a life cycle going around in it, they flee and they leave.
Hmm.
And they supposedly have meetings whether or not to leave or not. So they're treated as like sentient spirits of nature that are associated with buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So the Japanese mythology is that if you have an old abandoned like thing that's no longer used and is deteriorating, it's full of those.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you take an old house, you get it, those people have to meet together and decide if they want to leave or not.
I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but is it yokai, I think it is? All the very famous ghosts in Japan.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are discarded things, like an old shoe.
Yeah, yeah.
And things like that. And for some reason they have a spirit.
According to Japanese Shinto, or even animistic religions that predate that, everything has a spirit. You'll even hear that from modern mm-hmm. robotics engineers in Japan.
As I was saying, that explains why in anime you have so many of these like ghost in the machine type stories where mm-hmm.
or mechas that are alive, living and things.
Yeah, yeah, I'm still Western in my mind, and I think I was watching Blade Runner recently, yeah. and I was like, I can't watch this. It'd be like my toaster all of a sudden having feelings and starting crying. I'm not buying it.
Yeah, basically it's that everything, it has a spirit, a shoe, even a chair,
mm-hmm. broom.
A broom has a spirit. And a soul, and that is the belief of Japanese animistic religion in Shinto, is everything is alive in some way.
To borrow from Aristotle, I wonder if you break a broom in half, for example, mm-hmm. does it now have two spirits? I'm thinking about Aristotle's thing about the horse, and is a horse leg actually a horse?
That would be something really great to ask a Japanese philosopher. If everything has a spirit and you break it in two, is it two spirits or is it one spirit broken?
Yeah.
You know, or have you killed it, or what does that mean?
And what about subatomic particles?
Yeah.
Do they have spirits?
That would be an interesting question.
Are you going back to Japan soon, anytime?
I'm trying to. My dad wants me to visit. So.
Okay. Maybe you can find a philosopher while you're there.
Oh, no, there's several people. There's a folklorist on my island, so I could ask him.
Okay. Now, you've been to Japan and Okinawa, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your first impression of going there after being here?
Our dad dresses up like for New Year's in kimonos and things like that, but the rest of the time it was blue jeans and, you know, t-shirts and stuff. So when I first went to Japan, I truly believed in my head that everyone would be walking around in kimonos and wooden sandal shoes.
Yeah, it was samurai swords.
I believed this as a kid. I was so sure that was right, because every time my dad did Japanese stuff, we were always in kimonos. That's what they wear. And I even told my friends at school, yeah, in Japan everyone wears kimonos and everything all day. I believed it. So we flew over there, and none of the flight attendants wore them. And we got to the airport and went, wait, they're all just wearing regular clothes. Wait a minute. This isn't what I thought it was. But it was really cool when I first got there. My impression was, like, the airports were different. Seeing all the kanji and the language was, like, a really big experience for me. Just the attitude was different. It was a strange thing where everybody was polite. Everybody was nice. And you would see, like, businessmen who are flying, you know, from, you know, Nissan or whatever companies they're going to, they'd go to the bathroom and leave their briefcase right outside the bathroom, and no one would touch it.
Wow.
You go over here, no one would even in their right mind do that.
Right.
It was this whole trust mentality. It's so different. They have a crime rate. They do. But it's so small. And a large percent of criminals turn themselves in because they feel bad. I mean, so, you know, or they feel like dishonor their family. So it's like, you know, it's so weird.
If only they had that here.
It was a mentality, if you hurt the group, you hurt yourself.
Right.
Mentality, so it was really different. People go out of their way to help you, and you know.
So when you went to Japan and Okinawa and all that, what did the natives think of you?
I was afraid that they might not like me. And the reason I thought it was because when I was in the U.S., the first thing I experienced as a kid was constant racial bullying. People thought it was hilarious to make fun of you because you're Asian. Oh, you know, oh, you're Chinese, you know, squint in the eyes. That kind of, they thought, they love to do that, you know. So when I went to Japan, I thought, oh, no. They're not going to like me because I'm American. I'm going to be bullied by Japanese because that's what's going to happen to me. Because my whole life I was just bullied as a kid for being different and mixed. I went there and they loved me. They were so nice. But what did people think? They had a lot of precognitions. For one, they thought all Westerners like guns. And they're like, do you like Elvis? Elvis is so huge over there still. Yeah. The Beatles, they love them. I see a lot of people in America don't know who he is much these days, you know.
No, my wife and I went to Graceland, and I don't think I heard any English spoken. It was all these...
Yeah, but they had a lot of things like, you know, thinking all Americans like certain stuff. One of the families wanted to go eat, and there was only... Our island was really tiny. It's not like mainland Japan. There's no McDonald's there or anything like that. Movie theaters, nothing like that there. But there was a little hamburger restaurant inside of one of the little grocery stores. Like, the first place they tried to take me, want to get a hamburger? Oh, you want a hamburger? You know, that kind of thing. One of the first, like, presents my family got me there was a lot of Japanese gifts. You know, little wrapped in, like, cloths and stuff. But they also got me a pair of blue jeans. You're American. You should have some blue jeans.
That's,
you know,
so funny.
They were Levi's. And they're over there. They're, like, $150, $200 for one pair. Like, why'd you get me jeans? I have some, you know. They stuff like that. The things they expected you'd like and want. And they also didn't expect that I would know any Japanese. So they try to speak as much English to me as possible. Because I guess that's part of Japanese mentality, is they go out of the way for others to try to bridge it easier. So they weren't being rude about that, but they just, like, they expected that they would have to speak English to me, that I would like cowboy movies, and that I like all that stuff, you know. And it's like, well, I like some, you know, but actually I like a lot of samurai stuff.
Shinchiro loves to collect some of the traditional folklore on the Japanese side of his DNA, and he shared a few tales with us.
Are you familiar with Lake Biwa? It's the biggest lake in Japan. It's like 4 billion years, one of the oldest lakes in the world. It's, or at least in Japan anyway. It's on Honshu, and it's not pure anymore. It's been mixed with introduced species now and things, but it has a bunch of myths and folklore associated with it. One, is that of the Namazu. And that is, Japan tried to explain why earthquakes happened. And early Shinto and religions state that there's a giant catfish that lives under the ground in Lake Biwa. And when he shakes his tail and moves, there's earthquakes.
Oh.
And to stop this, the Japanese water god put a giant stone on the Namazu. And that stopped the earthquakes. But occasionally, the god gets lazy and loosens his grip on the stone. And it's able to shake again and cause another quake, which is why they still have earthquakes today. That's why they're not gone. The god gets lazy. So whenever that happens, you'll see some people go to the shrines and they'll like make offerings to try to get the water god to focus his attention on the stone.
Okay.
Around that island called Chikubu Island, Otsuru and Kame were two sisters about 300 years ago, approximately in Japan. And they were 15 and 11, respectively, about that. And one day, they were very close. Their parents were dead. They were being raised by their grandparent, so the story goes. The older Otsuru got sick one day from consumption of either bad food or illness and was getting deathly ill. So what Kame did was she had heard that there was a shrine on Chikubu Island to the goddess of mercy. And what she does is she decides in the middle of night to steal a boat, or borrow a boat, and slip off to the island and to go and try to pray for her sister's health. She goes to the island, prays all night to it, and then early in the morning starts heading back. But right as she is heading back, there's three like big storms in a row that hit, and a boat capsizes. And so the legend goes, there's a giant carp that lives on the island that likes to devour people, animals, pets, everything. It's considered an evil fish. But it's huge. Like a 9-footer giant fish. It's said to be like some evil spirit fish that wants to eat people. She's not a good swimmer anyway, but as she's falling into the water, the carp gets her and devours her. Well, the next day that, you know, they can't find her. They go looking for her and everything. And they find her boat still out in the water. Or remains of her footprints going to the shore. And they believe that she must have died trying to, you know, go to Chikubu Island to pray to the god of mercy, which is Kwannon. And what happens then is Otsuru, which is now basically upset that her sister has died trying to help her, decides that she shouldn't live anymore either, so she goes to the lake. The belief of, you know, Buddhism about rebirth is that she can be reborn again with her sister at the same time in the same spirit, possibly, if she dies with her. So she has to go to the lake. So she goes in a boat in the middle of the night again, just like her sister did, and goes up to the middle of the lake, where she thinks maybe the boat went down. She's guessing. And she tells the lake, you know, that if you took my sister, take me too. Jumps in there and tries to kill herself. And as she sinks to the bottom, she's already still sick anyway, sinks all the way to the bottom of the lake. And then she starts hearing her name being called underwater. She looks to her right or left, and there's a priest, an old priest sitting underwater next to her. And he tells her that basically, your life's not in vain, and both the priest and the spirits heard your sister's prayer for your health, and that you shouldn't die like that. It's not your time. You're not supposed to. They told her, go back up. You know, take my hand. I'll take you back to the shore. Go to Chikubu Island to the shrine where your sister went and pray to the night to Buddha, and then go home tomorrow. You know, like live on, basically. So she goes and does that, and he said, you will get vengeance for the carp that ate your sister. So she does. She goes and does exactly that. And she wakes up, you know, the next day, she falls asleep trying to pray to the shrine. Strange enough, she wakes up on the shore of the beach, as opposed to on the island. And her grandparent and the family in the village finds her. And next to her, coming to the shore, is the boat that she left in the middle of the lake. It's now coming back to her. And right near where the boat comes, like 10 feet away, is the 9-foot carp dead, just like the priest promised. And so the story goes, Otsuru, which is always just formal for like its honorable title, because I'll say Okami for her sister, but Susudu, but she doesn't get sick ever again, so the story goes. She's healthy the rest of her life. And not only that, she lives to be over 70 years old. And here's the fun thing with Japanese folklore is, later on, she historically meets Ota Nobunaga, which is Oda Nobunaga, one of the big unifiers of Japan before Tokugawa. He died before he could complete it. His son, who tried to finish it, was going to go to that area to destroy some of the local temples and these to destroy power. And supposedly he met Kame And she said, if you destroy any of the temples near Chikubu Island, I will personally see your demise through the priests that I know. And she was referring to the priests under the water. Mm-hmm. And supposed, according to that, he didn't destroy the temples on Chikubu Island.
Oh, wow.
Japanese folklore is never once upon a time stories. On the rare occasion they are, but most of the time, they actually have a general time frame and a date, and they're usually connected to historical events. In this case, someone actually, Nimkame, actually met Oda Nobunaga, so there is some truth to that story as occurring. And so even today, it's considered sacred, and there still is a shrine there to this day.
So how did your parents get together?
My dad has always been a very independent, not exactly with the rest of the group kind of guy, which is very unusual for Japan. As a teenager, he would go to Okinawa with his friends back when, you know, the 70s were in bell bottoms, and hop the ferry boat, go over to Okinawa and go look around and buy blue jeans and stuff. And then he'd come back, you know, the next day kind of thing. So he did kind of whatever he wanted. And after high school, he decided in his head, I'm going to go to America now. And so he just did it. Didn't make any plans. Didn't try to find like the family you can stay with and you can go through like organizations to find. He didn't find any setup like that or anything like that at all. Just hopped over. And he basically went over, enrolled in a school and all that stuff. And when he was going to school there, he met my mom over in Tennessee. She was originally from Whitwell, Tennessee, which is off Mount Eagle up there. My mom's family, my mom's dad's was like a coal miner. He died from like lung cancer from like coal mining and stuff. And when they met, they started just kind of being friends at first in school, and then they started dating. And then she brings him over to my grandmother's house down on Mount Eagle. And the first thing he does, he says hi to them and everything. And it's like, yeah, we got a stream in the back where we catch minnows and sometimes things like that, and you know, crawfish, things like that. He goes, oh really? He immediately goes out the back door, go grab something to catch him in. Catches a bunch of minnows. I'm talking those little minnows people use for bait. And he goes and takes them, goes into her kitchen, turns on the gas on the fry pan, and starts cooking them live right there. Doesn't even like, skin them. And cooks like 50 minnows up. And he sits them on a plate and starts eating them. And decides to offer it to everybody. I believe they tried some. And that's the first story of how he met my mom's parents and stuff. My grandpa from the USA, he thought it was funny. So they got along really well. I think about a year later, then they ended up getting married. And having eventually she got pregnant, and tried, you know, and they originally were both going to go in the Air Force together. But then she got pregnant, she dropped out of that to raise us, basically, and he continued with that. He was in the Air Force for a while. And we ended up popping around to Arizona and all these, you know, all these states, all across Alaska even. So I was born in Florida. So my two sisters were born in Alaska. My oldest sister was born in Tennessee. You know, we were born all over the place for that reason. We hopped around. And then eventually got a translator job for car plants, Japanese car, like Toyota and stuff. My dad and mom eventually separated.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Eventually. They didn't get along in the end. So he lives in Japan. She lives over here in Tennessee with us. He still lives on Arabu, farming the sugar cane with the family land down there. One issue I did want to bring up was people's view on cultural like preservation and how a culture does things versus globalization. And Japan is a really prime example of this because they are democratic, they're open to trades and other ideas come in. But up until after Tokugawa, they closed their borders and they kind of kept themselves the way they were. World War II changed all that.
But even after World War II, wasn't there... I know like in the late 60s, I think it was, they kind of went through this nationalistic phase. And
yeah, they did.
I only know because Akira Kurosawa had fallen out of favor. He was their top filmmaker, but then the way I understood it, because he was so popular in the West, he was like some kind of traitor or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was like relegated to make like whiskey commercials or something until, and the story goes that when Spielberg and Lucas made their millions, they went and dug him up and said, here's some money, make some movies, you know?
So if you look up japander.com, by the way.
Japander.com.
You see all the commercials of Western stars who've gone over and made the most bizarre spots. You know,
that was a bit in Lost in Transit.
Ewan McGregor selling coffee.
Yeah.
You know, changing into red suits. And Arnold Schwarzenegger riding a unicycle and spinning inside of a energy drink bottle, laughing like a crazy man. You know, it's some of the weirdest stuff. You should look it up.
In China, you'll see a lot of foreign celebrities being used to stunt for certain products, but... The thing is, they've not gotten their permission. They just steal the photo and One of the more famous cases, I think this was Beckham, the soccer player.
Yeah, yeah.
Some fledgling condom company in China put his image on the box and got and ended up being like some of the biggest selling condoms. That's the story I was told.
Does he know this?
Oh, I'm sure he does now, but he wasn't asked his permission.
I wonder how he feels about that.
Yeah, that's right. You were saying, we're getting off the subject.
Okay. But Tokugawa, who unified Japan, he was the successor of Oda, who was assassinated. He unified Japan, and the first thing he did was he locked off the borders. You know, they killed off missionaries, they did whatever they wanted to do, they closed off their stuff to keep their culture isolated. Mm-hmm. But then after that, when the empirical Japan started, the empire kind of lied and got the shogun stuff removed, because the Tokugawa eventually started opening borders a little bit, and the empirical Japan said, we're going to open border, we're going to close them back for you. And so a lot of Japan sided with the empire, mm-hmm. and as soon as they successfully took Japan from the shoguns, the first thing they did was open up trade with the West mm-hmm. and allow the steamships in. If the second that happened, they basically lied mm-hmm. to get that done. Which has no bearings on modern people. That's what they did back then.
No, it's something about, as an American, you know, when you go to a foreign country yeah. and you expect to see, kind of like you did, where you expected yeah. to see people in kimonos and, yeah. and dinosaurs stepping on buildings and all that.
Yeah.
When I went to China, I was disappointed that some of their favorite TV show was Friends. I'm like, that sucks. You know, I was
yeah,
like,
I know.
We get that. But at the same time, We love it as Americans, and I don't see how we couldn't, because we're all mixed up.
Yeah,
you know, we love absorbing okay. other cultures, mm-hmm. and but for some reason we want those cultures to stay the same. We like that romanticized
yeah.
idea.
I guess my issue with it is mm-hmm. Japanese culture disappeared really badly for a while. It was the geishas that saved Japan's culture. The women of Japan kept wearing kimonos up to the 60s. They kept wearing the kimonos. Mm-hmm. They still knew how to do the old hairstyles and how to make the chonmaje that the sumo wrestlers wearing, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They kept that stuff alive when men were trying to wear suits and made them modern as possible. We actually owe it to the geishas for saving Japan. Mm-hmm. And it's any of its original cultures. Some of its origamis and its art, they preserved it. Woodblock carving, which was done by the samurais, which would be in front, they kept it. And then you come to the modern time. Japan made, I mean, they made the Nintendo, they made all this stuff and technology. They're one of the big tech centers of the world. Mm-hmm. And they've got so much stuff you can find, like, you know, Levi's blue jeans and all this cool stuff over there. And they mm-hmm. have Western stars in their commercials and all these neat things. Is there a loss to globalization versus the cultural ceiling methodology? Mm-hmm. I mean, can cultures globalize to a global internet, a global world caring about the environment, you know, universe? Because if everyone doesn't do it, it doesn't work. Can there be a worldwide human rights bill, all that kind of stuff, internet, and people spreading around the world? Mm-hmm. Can you learn about another culture? But at the end of the day, are you still going to wake up, put on your kimono? Mm-hmm. Or are you going to go buy some Levi's? Is there a way to... Can that balance, or yeah. is there no win on that?
First, I'll go back to some of our contradictions in the West. So, for example, a lot of people in America resent McDonald's and Walmart and these yeah. things that are very homogenized, gentrified, yeah. and they like regionalism. But you will find, when you talk to them about politics, they very much want their view of politics pushed on everybody else.
Yeah.
They may not like corporations, but they would really like the American government to have more control and more centralized, because they feel like their way is the best, and, you know, all that. Yeah. So I think we contradict ourselves on a lot of things. I guess my opinion, if you're asking, is I think you have to let things flow and let people make their own as individuals.
Yeah.
And... You know, some people are going to be traditional about certain things, and some people are always going to embrace the new, and some yeah. people may mix the two. And I wish I could remember this. There's an Indian writer. I heard a great interview with him, and he wrote this book about the history of globalization. And he points out it's not a new thing. I mean, this,
no.
You know, you look back, the Silk Road
exactly.
is a great example of globalization at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go along the Silk Road to this day, I mean, you will find where cultures mixed.
Yeah.
You know, even in close to where I was at in Xi'an, China, you know, you find a Muslim section still, because the Muslims came with the Silk Road. You find Christians, you find Jews, and you find little bits of their culture still, you know, somewhat.
Somehow kind of like China kind of spread its written language around. So that's why, like, Korean, Japanese, a lot of those have very similar kanji-like writings. Mm-hmm. They spread that. Mm-hmm.
To this day, China still complains about the Chinese abandoning traditional Chinese
yeah.
and the West really imposing its cultural
yeah.
will on them. But they do the same thing with Tibet.
In my mind, there is a utopian vision where, like, you have cultures learning about each other, mm-hmm. ending the racial stupidities people have about, like, oh, yeah, you know... Chinese people all, you know, you all have pointy eyes, you know, eat rice, you know, mm-hmm. ending that kind of stereotypes. Mm-hmm. but also where cultures could learn by each other and also but keep some of their own things they do without wanting to change as much. Because one day I remember I worked at a McDonald's and a guy came in and ordered his food wearing a kilt and the full Scottish garb, everything. He was red-haired with a beard and everything. And I just thought, that is so awesome. He's like, well, because I'm Scottish, I want to show my culture. I'm like, you know, I wish more people would do that because it's so neat.
But he's still eating at McDonald's. Which,
yeah.
Which I guess technically is Mick. That would be Scottish. But
there you go. It's like Mick.
I don't think the cheeseburger came from Scotland, but I'm all about preserving. But, you know, things do, even in nature, they... Even before humanity was a factor, I mean, there's all kinds of animals that don't exist anymore.
Nature's constant change. People want to keep it the same, but nature wants to change and move.
I think the problem is when you have, like, cultural genocide where someone comes in and forces.
Yeah.
Either, like you're saying with the Japanese and Okinawa, or even forced to stay the same. Like, if you say, hey, man, you can't change, that's not cool.
By the way, the book on the history of globalization that I couldn't remember was called Bound Together by Nyan Chanda. The In the Corner Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.